We need to disturb the sound of silence this morning and delve deeper into current news, and no one better to do that with than psychologist Professor Mark Wilson from Victoria University. Morena, Mark.
Kia ora, Jim. Great to hear from you.
Very nice of you to join us. Donald Trump released his sneaker range, the Never Surrender High Tops. Limited range of 1,000 of them at $399 each. A reviewer in a liberal publication called them the ugliest shoe I ever saw in my life. The salient point is made that Donald Trump himself will never be seen dead in them. My question, Mark, is how have shoes become such status symbols? I mean, there'll be people listening who say they always have, but not in this way. I mean, aside from the usual explanation about wanting to belong to a tribe, which we always hear, what's the reason? How we are tribal has changed?
I'm not sure I feel flattered that we're turning to this as the first question. I think one thing that's pretty clear from looking at these shoes is they're not really intended to be shoes, right? There's clearly something else going on here, and that's why we're having the conversation. Sure, clothes have been status symbols for as long as we've had clothes, but I think there's been an interesting change sometime in the relatively recent past where it's not just about having nice things that signals our status, but particular brands of things. And in a lot of the research that I do around sort of what I'd call consumer psychology, I often talk about the two functions that the things that we purchase may have. One of them is they serve some kind of instrumental function. So a shoe is something you put on your feet so your feet don't get wet. But we also have a tendency to buy things that may express something about ourselves. And that's what's going on here. People who are buying these are expressing something. They're expressing, amongst other things, that they have enough money to buy an ugly pair of shoes, which might make them a status symbol. But they're also an indication of this tribal thing, right? What tribe do you belong to? And it's not, I don't think there'll be that many people in New Zealand who will be purchasing these shoes online, but come rugby season, I'm pretty sure we're going to see people going onto the streets wearing their All Black merchandise, and it'll serve many of the same sorts of functions. And one of the things that happens when the All Blacks lose a game is that people go out and buy even more merchandise so that they can try and change the outcome. And I think that's kind of what's going on here. People are trying to signal something. It's social signaling, but it's also trying to bring about an outcome that clearly they must want to happen really, really badly.
Yeah, that's smart analysis. But I think, and the All Blacks reference is very germane, but I think when I was young, if someone had suggested I'd start buying apparel with logos on so I could advertise what I'd already paid a lot of money for, I would have been incredulous, you know, unless it was an All Black jersey which says you like the All Blacks. But, you know, just buying logo purchases, why do we need to be tribal in that way?
The most fascinating thing about this is that the change that has occurred that now means that we pay for the privilege of advertising the people we buy the clothes from. And that is just absolutely intriguing to me. And this hasn't happened by accident. It's happened through a combination of different sorts of things. It's the feeling of exclusivity that comes with having something that not everyone else has, for example. And I suspect that that's part of what's playing out here. Why do we need to be tribal in this way? Well, I mean, I could probably spin some kind of intellectual evolutionary psychology story about how being able to walk down the street and see people who are wearing the same sort of symbols as we do makes us feel like we're a part of something. It tells us who we can go to in times of trouble and who's going to provide support and who we need to provide support to. But this seems to be a kind of suborning of that inbuilt adaptive tendency.
Yeah, that's interesting analysis too. Yeah, you do fit in a club as soon as you get the right logo on. Dr. John Gartner is a well-known American psychologist. He has written a piece in Salon magazine about the difference between the brains of Donald Trump and Joe Biden. Quote, Biden's brain is aging, Trump's brain is dementing. Obviously, there is bias in nearly everything written about the two of them, and this is no exception. Dr. Gartner is very anti-Trump, but he makes an argument that you can assess better than we can about why he makes that distinction. What do you think?
This is so pertinent now. I mean, for people who do addictively follow American politics like I do, the State of the Nation address was given just a couple of nights ago by President Biden, and it's been taken as something of a referendum on this argument that Biden is frail and in cognitive decline. And to all accounts, he seems to have set some people's concerns at ease, leading some of the conservative media to speculate that, in fact, because he wasn't sleepy, just had been drugged up at the time. This is easy for us here in New Zealand, I think, to treat like a spectator sport, but actually it clearly has implications for the way that the world operates, because whoever wins this competition is going to be one of the most powerful people in the world. So this is a relevant conversation to be having. Now, you've already noted that a lot of attention is paid to these two men, and I think as a result of that, we probably pay more attention to the gaffes that they make than we might if it was our father on the phone, or if it was ourselves, because we tend in our conversations with people to edit out all of the ums, the missteps, the changes in direction, the contradictions, to make a more sort of seamless gist out of it. In short, the way that we talk in real life is not like a scripted TV show. And we just don't tend to realize this, but when our attention is drawn to Donald Trump or Joe Biden making these kinds of mistakes, I think that they sound more egregious and more obvious than they actually are. The important question here is whether or not the gaffes that the two men make is a sign of something more problematic.
Yeah.
It's been suggested that for Joe Biden, a man who has suffered from a stutter for most of his life, that we should excuse some of these sorts of gaffes. At the same time, it's also clear if you go and listen to recordings of him from earlier on in his political career, he was a little bit more vigorous, a little bit more articulate, and didn't seem to make as many mistakes as he does now. But the same thing applies to Donald Trump. So in 2016, 2017, there were a couple of analyses of Trump's interviews from the 80s and 90s, comparing him with his speeches in the mid-2010s, which quite clearly show a reduction in linguistic sophistication. He uses fewer words now. He appears to be less articulate. He seems to change subjects more frequently than he used to do. Now, these could be signs of a range of things. One of them could be age-related changes. One of them could even be self-presentational. It's not unreasonable to think that if you're trying to sell something and you want to sell it to people who might be a little bit cynical or skeptical if you use long, fancy words, that you're going to stop doing that. And also, these kinds of mistakes can also be a sign of tiredness, stress, frustration. I reckon that probably applies to the job of president. What's the difference between normal mistakes related to age and dementia? Well, memory loss is really quite common as part of normal aging. For example, about 40% of people over 65 will experience mild but not debilitating memory loss. And by this, I mean things that don't noticeably disrupt your life or interfere with normal tasks. You don't experience difficulty learning things, and there's no underlying medical complaint. But it's certainly also the case that as we get older, we experience cognitive slowing. So my 20-year-old self is going to be probably about 50% faster than I am at sort of cognitive tests. Now, we'll probably come to the same answer at the other end, but I'm going to be a little bit slower. And some of that's to do with the way that working memory declines. I think it's incredibly difficult to diagnose at distance whether or not either of these men is experiencing cognitive decline. It's reasonable to think that there's quite a wide range of challenges or errors that people can make before it becomes really clear that there's a deeper problem underlying them.
Yeah. The contention was that Trump engages in what this guy called tangential speech. He just becomes incomprehensible when he engages in free association, word salad speech. And I wondered if that was a sufficient criterion, because, I mean, Biden, that's Trump, and Biden said he'd been talking to a dead French president. He mispronounced the name of a young woman killed by an illegal immigrant the other day, which was, I think, just a memory lapse. But, yeah, as you say, both of them are doing a version of roughly the same thing, except Trump probably rants a bit more. Would that be fair?
Yeah. probably rants a bit more.
Sorry.
That's probably a bit of a given. Yeah, I think the example you've given of the speech the other night is a good one. And again, in terms of normal age-related memory issues, finding it hard to bring to mind the name of an acquaintance or someone you met a year ago or someone who you actually don't know very well is actually pretty common. If you can't recognise your members of your family, that's going to be a bit more of an issue.
Yeah, indeed. Professor Mark Wilson is with us. AI girlfriends and boyfriends are becoming popular. No surprise. One of the big operators here is, not in New Zealand, but one of the big operators, is a site called Replica, which has been in the news, but there seem to be quite a few of them. A man is profiled by Canada's CTV who has Marfan syndrome and whose normal dating is inhibited, but nevertheless he wants a romantic partner. We've seen movies with this as a theme, but in these movies the AI companion seems pretty human, which AI is not yet. Is there anything about this trend towards AI girlfriends and boyfriends that you're worried about?
I think this is such a great topic, and absolutely, certainly not one conversation we'd have been having maybe even 10 years ago.
Yeah.
So I think that, like most things, there are going to be potential pros and cons to this. So on the first hand, AI-based romantic partners as a phenomenon that's adjacent to other things that we probably have taken for granted for a long time. For example, people routinely develop what we call parasocial relationships with fictional characters or the actors who portray them on television or on the radio or other forms of media. For example, why were so many people so distressed at the death of Princess Diana, even though they'd never actually met her? Well, the argument is made that for at least some people, she was as ubiquitous in their lives as maybe people, members of their family who they didn't necessarily see too much. So we tend to develop these deeper connections to the kinds of characters, actors, figures that we intellectually interact with on a regular basis. In fact, the more time we spend with a fictional character, the more we feel we know them and the more we anthropomorphize them. One of the things that interests me in this context is there's an awful lot of fan fiction online associated with many TV shows or movies where people write out scenarios where they reimagine what was going on in characters' heads while they were interacting, or change the interactions in ways that bring them closer to us. And what I would say is that the new generation of chatbots or large language models communicate in ways that can sound kind of convincing. And as a result, I think they trigger our faculty for ascribing intentionality, right? So we're these pattern matching machines that are kind of adapted to try and make connections between the things that we see in the world. And if we see things that look as if they have intention or that they have causality, then we tend to infer that that's actually what's really going on.
Yeah.
While we vary in our extent of our capacity to empathy is also an adaptive characteristic. So we're not just empathizing with these AIs that aren't real, but we're also inferring that they empathize with us too. And there are also, I think, potential downsides to these kinds of things. I mean, for example, one of the things I thought of was one of the sort of moral challenges around charging people for a connection with a romantic AI. Some of the research that's been done looking at people's use of Replica suggests that for at least some people, one Stanford study had 1,000 people, 30 of whom spontaneously commented that they felt that they would not be alive now if it wasn't for the opportunity to interact with these AIs and to talk through suicidal thoughts, for example. What happens if the company gets back to you and says, oh, we're raising the price and you can no longer pay it?
I think that's
potentially an issue.
Yeah, and I think data privacy is potentially an issue. But does it hurt to have a faux someone in your life that will tell you you're wonderful, basically?
Again, to a point, I don't think it's a problem. And I'll take a step to the side to talk about, this is such a cutting edge area of research. We don't know a lot about these kind of artificial friends or artificial romantic partners, but we're getting a better sense over the last few years about how effective these kinds of chatbots might be for things like general mental health support. Right, so particularly for people who may not be experiencing really serious psychological distress, but it potentially there's the question of whether or not having an interaction with a chatbot that you know isn't real, but who can give you really sensible mental health related advice might be a good thing. And recent reviews of the effectiveness of chatbots in this context suggest that they can be effective in at least slightly improving depression, distress, stress, and other forms of psychological concern. even though they don't actually make people feel subjectively better about things. At the same time, it would be deeply problematic if these things come to replace the kinds of relationships that we normally have. One of my concerns about them is that I have what I hope is a deep and enduring connection with my wife, but there are times when I really irritate her, and she says so. I'm not entirely sure whether or not whether people would even pay for a service for an artificial partner who would complain and tell them when they've done things wrong. So again, up to a point, but again, no replacement for face-to-face relationships.
That's probably all we've got time to talk about, but it's obviously a coming area. And you know, when I was reading this piece, I suddenly realized that there'll be a whole lot of people around the world who already have artificial boyfriends and girlfriends, and you know, and that's already here. It's just a question of the level of sophistication from now on in.
And the Wild West around the provision of these things. So there seem to be a number of companies that are now doing it, and I'm guessing these are relatively unregulated.
I think you'd be guessing right. Professor Mark Wilson, thank you. Very nice to have you on, as always.